Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 10, Chapter 14. Well, is she pretty? Our friend, my pink one, is delicious. Her name is Dunyasha. But on glancing at Rostov's face, Ilyin stopped short. He saw that his hero and commander was following quite a different train of thought. Rostov glanced angrily at Ilyin, and without replying strode off with rapid steps to the village. "I'll show them, I'll give it them, the brigands," said he to himself. Alpatish, at a gliding trot only just managed not to run, kept up with him with difficulty. "What decision have you been pleased to come to?" said he. Rostov stopped and, clenching his fists suddenly and sternly, turned on Alpatish. "Decision? What decision, old dotard?" cried he. "What have you been about, eh? The peasants are rioting and you can't manage them? You're a traitor yourself. I know you. I'll flay you all alive." And as if afraid of wasting his store of anger, he left Alpatish and went rapidly forward. Alpatish, mastering his offended feelings, kept pace with Rostov at a gliding gait and continued to impart his views. He said the peasants were obdurate and that at the present moment it would be imprudent to over-resist them without an armed force. And would it not be better first to send for the military? "I'll give them armed force. I'll over-resist them," uttered Rostov meaninglessly, breathless with irrational animal fury and the need to vent it. Without considering what he would do, he moved unconsciously with quick, resolute steps towards the crowd. And the nearer he drew to it, the more Alpatish felt that this unreasonable action might produce good results. The peasants in the crowd were similarly impressed when they saw Rostov's rapid, firm steps and resolute, frowning face. After the hussars had come to the village and Rostov had gone to see the princess, a certain confusion and dissension had arisen among the crowd. Some of the peasants said that these new arrivals were Russians and might take it amiss that the mistress was being detained. Dron was of this opinion, but as soon as he expressed it, Karp and others attacked their ex-elder. "How many years have you been fattening on the commune?" Karp shouted at him. "It's all one to you. You'll dig up your pot of money and take it away with you. What does it matter to you whether our homes are ruined or not?" "We've been told to keep order and that no one is to leave their homes or take away a single grain, and that's all about it," cried another. "It was your son's turn to be conscripted, but no fear. You begrudged your lump of a son." A little old man suddenly began attacking Dron. "And so they took my Vanka to be shaved for a soldier. But we all have to die." "To be sure, we all have to die. I'm not against the commune," said Dron. "That's it, not against it. You've filled your belly." The two tall peasants had their say. As soon as Rostov, followed by Ilyin, Lavrushka, and Alpatish, came up to the crowd, Karp, thrusting his fingers into his belt and smiling a little, walked to the front. Dron, on the contrary, retired to the rear, and the crowd drew closer together. "Who is your elder here, hey?" shouted Rostov, coming up to the crowd with quick steps. "The elder? What do you want with him?" asked Karp. But before the words were well out of his mouth, his cap flew off, and a fierce blow jerked his head to one side. "Caps off, traitors!" shouted Rostov in a wrathful voice. "Where's the elder?" he cried furiously. "The elder, he wants the elder. Dron Zakharych. You." Meek and flustered voices here and there were heard calling, and the caps began to come off their heads. The footnote says the use of Dron's patronymic Zakharych, son of Zacharias, indicates that the peasants were no longer speaking familiarly, but wished to be as formal and ceremonious as possible. "We don't riot, we're following the orders," declared Karp, and at that moment several voices began speaking together. "It's as the old men have decided. There's too many of you giving orders. "Arguing, mutiny, brigands, traitors!" cried Rostov, unmeaningly in a voice not his own, gripping Karp by the collar. Bind him," he shouted, though there was no one to bind him but Lavrushka and Alpatych. Lavrushka, however, ran up to Karp and seized him by the arms from behind. "Shall I call up our men from behind the hill?" he called out. Alpatych turned to the peasants and ordered two of them by name to come and bind Karp. The men obediently came out of the crowd and began taking off their belts. "Where's the elder?" demanded Rostov in a loud voice. With a pale and frowning face, John stepped out of the crowd. "Are you the elder? Bind him, Lavrushka," shouted Rostov, as if that order too could not possibly be met with any opposition. And, in fact, two more peasants began binding John, who took off his own belt and handed it to them as if to aid them. "And you all listen to me," said Rostov to the peasants. "Be off to your houses at once, and don't let one of your voices be heard." "Why, we haven't done any harm. We did it just out of foolishness. It's all nonsense." "I said then that it was not in order." Voices were heard bickering with one another. "There, what did I say?" said Alpatych, coming into his own again. "It's wrong, lads." "All our stupidity, Yakov Alpatych," came the answers, and the crowd began at once to disperse through the village. The two bound men were led off to the master's house. The two drunken peasants followed them. "Aye, when I look at you," said one of them to Karp. "How can one talk to the masters like that? What were you thinking of, you fool?" added the other. "A real fool." 2 hours later, the carts were standing in the courtyard of the Bogacharovo house. The peasants were briskly carrying out the proprietor's goods and packing them on the carts, and Dron, liberated at Princess Mary's wish from the cupboard where he had been confined, was standing in the yard directing the men. "Don't put it in so carelessly," said one of the peasants, a man with a round smiling face, taking a casket from a housemaid. "You know it has cost money. How can you chuck it in like that or shove it under the cord where it'll get rubbed? I don't like that way of doing things. Let it all be done properly, according to rule. Look here. Put it in under the ballast mating, and cover it with hay. That's the way." "Eh? Books, books," said another peasant, bringing out Prince Andrew's library cupboards. "Don't catch up against it. It's heavy, lads. Solid books." "Yes, they worked all day and didn't play," remarked the tail, round-faced peasant, gravely pointing with a significant wink at the dictionaries that were on the top. Unwilling to obtrude himself on the princess, Rostov did not go back to the house, but remained in the village awaiting her departure. When her carriage drove out of the house, he mounted and accompanied her 8 miles from Bogacharovo to where the road was occupied by our troops. At the inn at Yonkovo, he respectfully took leave of her, for the first time permitting himself to kiss her hand. "How can you speak so?" he blushingly replied to Princess Mary's expressions of gratitude for her deliverance, as he termed what had occurred. "Any police officer would have done as much. If we had had only peasants to fight, we should not have let the enemy come so far," said he with a sense of shame and wishing to change the subject. "I am only happy to have had the opportunity of making your acquaintance. Goodbye, Princess. I wish you happiness and consolation, and hope to meet you again in happier circumstances. If you don't want to make me blush, please don't thank me." But the princess, if she did not again thank him in words, thanked him with the whole expression of her face, radiant with gratitude and tenderness. She could not believe that there was nothing to thank him for. On the contrary, it seemed to her certain that had he not been there, she would have perished at the hands of the mutineers and of the French, and that he had exposed himself to terrible and obvious danger to save her, and even more certain was it that he was a man of lofty and noble soul, able to understand her position and her sorrow. His kind, honest eyes, with the tears rising in them when she herself had begun to cry as she spoke of her loss, did not leave her memory. When she had taken leave of him and remained alone, she suddenly felt her eyes filling with tears, and then, not for the first time, the strange question presented itself to her. Did she love him? On the rest of the way to Moscow, though the princess's position was not a cheerful one, Dunyasha, who went with her in the carriage, more than once noticed that her mistress leaned out of the window and smiled at something with an expression of mingled joy and sorrow. Well, supposing I do love him, thought Princess Mary. Ashamed as she was of acknowledging to herself that she had fallen in love with a man who would perhaps never love her, she comforted herself with the thought that no one would ever know it, and that she would not be to blame if, without ever speaking of it to anyone, she continued to the end of her life to love the man with whom she had fallen in love for the first and last time in her life. Sometimes when she recalled his looks, his sympathy, and his words, happiness did not appear impossible to her. It was at those moments that Dunyasha noticed her smiling as she looked out of the carriage window. Was it not fate that brought him to Bogotyrovo, and at that very moment, thought Princess Mary, and that caused his sister to refuse my brother? And in all this Princess Mary saw the hand of Providence. The footnote says, a woman might not marry her brother's or sister's brother-in-law and vice versa, so that if Natasha had married Prince Andrew, it would have been an obstacle to marriage between Mary and Nicholas. The impression the princess made on Rostov was a very agreeable one. To remember her gave him pleasure, and when his comrades, hearing of his adventure at Bogotyrovo, rallied him on having gone to look for hay and having picked up one of the wealthiest heiresses in Russia, he grew angry. It made him angry, just because the idea of marrying the gentle Princess Mary, who was attractive to him and had an enormous fortune, had against his will more than once entered his head. For himself, personally, Nicholas could not wish for a better wife. By marrying her, he would make the Countess his mother happy, would be able to put his father's affairs in order, and would even, he felt it, ensure Princess Mary's happiness. But Sonya, and his plighted word, that was why Rostov grew angry when he was rallied about Princess Bolkonskaya. Alright, there we go, another chapter down, and it looks like Nicholas Bolkonsky has a conscience after all. That last line there, he's angry thinking about how much he loves this new woman in his life, Princess Maya, because he feels guilty about his promise that he's made to Sonya. Guilty, and also he feels honor-bound. Obi-Wan Spicoli said about this chapter, "Hats off, traitors. My man Nikolai. He reminds me a bit of Denisov, with his own little Nikolai in tow in the form of Ilyin." Huh, very cool. Yeah, Nikolai was pretty badass in this chapter, wasn't he? Marching up to those peasants, knocking the hat off one of them, and showing them what's what. He was completely unstoppable in that moment. Kansas 57 said, "Let's just muse on the hilarity of the rebels' easy fall to Rostov. What was the purpose of their stand, and why would they give in so easily?" I think it was a simple thing of some men in very spiffy-looking military uniforms came up full of confidence with no doubt in their mind. Well, actually, I think there's only one person in uniform, that was Rostov. Is that correct? Well, at least one of them was in a uniform. And it sort of implied that there was no way they were about to lose this battle, and it was absolutely appalling what these peasants were up to, and the peasants just sort of bent to their will. Rostov's confidence just completely overrode whatever they were up to. It was pretty cool to watch. 100157 says, "I figure the rebels were panicked. That, plus their native irrationality and drunkenness, makes for a derpy revolt, quelled by any strong leader. Plus, the headman didn't really seem committed. It was just mob mentality, maybe some comic relief as well. Liking the romantic tension here, maybe poor Sonya gets her heart broken, but Andrei swoops in to pick up the pieces." Rory Lenigan responded to that, saying, "That's how I felt about the mob as well. I like how Tolstoy used this situation to illustrate how easily an uprising can fall apart and turn on itself with only the semblance of an actual authority figure." Very cool. Between 100157 and Rory Lenigan, I think that's a really good summary of how Rostov has gone in, just one person really, and stopped a mini rebellion from rising. Now, I don't know if it was just the translation that I'm reading, but there was parts in this where it was kind of like Maya was saying sometimes she would remember back about that. And it was almost like, and I think it also said for the first and last time she ever fell in love. And I read it like hints that she never fell in love again. And that was it for her. That was her last chance at love, and it came and went. I'm hoping I'm wrong there. I'm hoping they do end up together, but it almost seemed like the narrator was telling us that Maya doesn't end up with anyone. Oh dear, I hope that's not the case. I quite like Maya. Alright, anyway, on that note, we're going to wrap up this episode. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.